another podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.
From the intersection of technology and public accounting,
it's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession. Tech2Go is sponsored by ADP.
Hello, Greg LaFollette, Intersection Live Recording, Episode 11 of Tech2Go. And I want to welcome all of our panelists. As usual, we were spread out over, in this case, four different time zones in about five hours, because my friend Randy Johnston is suffering, sweating over a hot beach chair in Honolulu. Good morning, Randy.
Hey, good morning. It's great to be out here on the lanai drinking a little Kona coffee and looking at Waikiki.
Well, you know, everybody's got to have a problem somewhere along the line, and you know, I feel for you. As you know, I just returned from 10 days on the Big Island, and it was 40 degrees when I got home, and that was real rude because I hadn't felt 40 degrees in a while. So I appreciate you getting up early this morning. I know that you've only been in Hawaii for a couple of days, so that real early doesn't bother you a whole lot. But thanks so much for being here. Representing the East Coast contingent, Dave McClure is with us. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, guys.
Glad you could join us mid-morning out there, 11 o'clock out in the Eastern time zone. And finally, in the Pacific Northwest, as usual, our good friend Brent Goodfellow. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, Randy. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, so we got everybody here. So welcome and thanks to everybody for agreeing to schedule some time for us. And we want to start obviously by thanking our sponsor ADP. They're helping us pay the bandwidth, and that's certainly appreciated. You know, I took a look just the other day at the ADP accountants special website, and I was showing somebody in a firm as we were talking about year-end stuff and payroll, and they were telling me how they try and get through all their different payroll things, and I took them over to this is out at the Thompson conference. I took them over to one of the guest computers that they had there for email, and I pulled up this year-end checklist that ADP has, and pretty soon we had a whole group around there looking at this thing. It's the stuff that these guys give away is actually pretty impressive. So you guys, if you're doing any payroll or talking to anybody about, you know, that does payroll, have them check that ADP website. And there's a special slot in there for accountants, and they've got a really detailed checklist that describes everything to do before your last payroll of the calendar year, which is real important, and then another follow-on checklist for everything to do after your last payroll, but before the first payroll of the new calendar year. So it's kind of one of those times to correct a lot of sins. So have you guys ever taken a look at that accountant's website?
Well, I've looked at the website. I haven't looked at it recently for the payroll piece. I'll go back and look at it now.
Yeah, it's interesting. So if you run into anybody that's using it or that's doing payroll, send them over there. Anyway, thanks to the guys at ADP for sponsoring Tech2Go. I certainly appreciate them. So we've got a bunch of things to talk about today, and one of the things I put on the list, and I sent this out to all the panelists, and I'd like to get their reaction to this at the CCH Users Conference down in Dallas a couple of weeks ago. They had Yeah. You know, around, I think, about 750 attendees, plus must have been 800, certainly well over 800 people total. Pretty darn good for a third year conference, and by far, I mean, the classiest conference in the profession, no doubt. Interesting things going on. They did a journalist briefing, and one of the things that Mike Sabatis announced to us, and he's president, as you know, president of the CCH US group, and Mike announced that CCH was in process of building an SDK for their ProSystem FX platform. So they see this, you know, as they've tied in, you know, tax and engagement and document and all of these other things, they've determined that ProFX is now a platform. And they're writing, as they talked about it being open, I kind of leaned over and I see Jim Ryan over there, you know, their vice president of development, and I caught his eye and I said, "Does that mean that you're building an SDK?" And he said, "Absolutely." I think that's a pretty interesting move. Brent, your shop is a ProFX shop, and you use some other items that you've kind of tied into it. What's your reaction to the SDK announcement?
I think it's good for the profession because Wolters Kluwer is now recognizing that opening their development base or code base, if you will, ultimately enhances their product as third-party vendors develop add-ons and enhancements. It benefits the end users, of course, and I think it benefits Wolters Kluwer as well.
Well, I mean, I certainly see a chance for, you know, I hate to say that ecosystem, but when you go to the Sage conference, for example, and Randy, you're you know, you speak at that conference almost every year. I mean, they have literally hundreds of exhibitors of booths there that are all tie-in products. Because Sage opens their software and people tie into it. It's same thing with Intuit.
Yeah, that's really true. If you look at the accounting software marketplace, most of the accounting software publishers concluded early on that they really couldn't build everything that needed to be done to get a complete solution. So they made it easy for third-party developers to interface products. And as you point out, you know, Sage in their product lines, I can't even be accurate on the number, but I know they have at least 1,500 plus for MES 90 alone, and that's just the ones that they actually control now through acquisition. My best guess is there's tens of thousands of third-party add-ins, and that's no exaggeration. You know, the whole CCH strategy, the good news, I guess, Greg, is I've known about that for quite a number of months, so I've had quite some time to think about that. And because of my efforts with CCH and the .NET project, I can't disclose some things that I know that are going on. But I can tell you that this ability to choose and integrate with their product lines will be very attractive to many firms of all sizes. But particularly, I think the larger firms will wind up with the capabilities of customizing applications for their own environment. And it does provide third parties to integrate very, very tightly with the platform as it arrives.
Now, Brent, you use a document management system that's not the ProFX system, and you've managed to kind of work around and make that integrate. You know, those guys out there, that's a Portland-based company that you use. Talk to me about those guys, and you know, would they be one of the first people, I would think, to jump on an SDK, wouldn't they?
No question about it. You know, their product uses SQL Server, and it ties into the Explorer for ease of use, and so you know, they're looking for opportunities to tie into industry-specific applications. They're continually looking for those, and I'm sure they'll be interested in it.
Well, you know, we've watched other examples of groups that decided to be open, and other groups that have kind of decided to be closed. And I mean, I kind of look at it and say, well, you got Bill Gates on one side and Steve Jobs on the other. It's pretty obvious that open kind of a platform is pretty successful. Dave, you've seen this in lots of things. What's your reaction?
I guess that, you know, the first thing that strikes me about it, Greg, is that this is a real boon not only for enterprise-sized organizations but for small organizations as well, simply because of the flexibility it brings. You know, now you've got a cadre of potentially thousands of integrators and programmers who can, I think it was Randy who noted, who can begin now to customize this platform in ways it's never been done before. I'm all in favor, not so much of open systems, but of open development kits that enable organizations to build their software their way. And I think it's a marvelous step on CCH's part.
Well, the Intuit group on, at least at the QuickBooks level, not over on the ProTax side, but at the QuickBooks level, have certainly prospered since they wrote that SDK, I think, maybe, what, 5 years ago? Is that about right, Randy?
Yeah, I believe that was the 2001 time frame. So, yeah. You're right.
And I mean, their adoption has been huge, and so and we've already talked about Sage, and now we got CCH. Any thoughts or opinions on what the Thompson Group would do with something like this?
Well, you know, I really know better than I, Greg, on this one. But just watching what's happening, not only in the traditional CS product line, but what's happening in the traditional RIA and PPC product lines, you know, I think we're starting to see integration across more of those items. And as they continue to evolve the products, they're allowing more and more functionality hooked together between different systems. So I think you're actually going to see a bit like that. But, you know, historically, they've kept their connections very close to the chest and not really had much of a public interface. So if they make it a public approach, that'll be a change in direction for them.
Well, you know, I really see John Barron very much like Steve Jobs. If he'd wear a black turtleneck, they'd probably be the same people. I did talk with John about this. That whole CS line is so incredibly tightly integrated, and it works so seamlessly. The reason it does that is the same reason that my iPod works so seamlessly with iTunes, because Steve Jobs says this is the way it's going to be, and we're not going to let anybody touch it. And so you get that really incredibly tight integration, but then you get people pushing around the edges saying we want to do a little more. So I kind of see it as a classic difference of opinion. It's not right or wrong. It's just a completely different approach. You know, let's drop. Kind of sounds like the ProFX the SDK thing is we kind of talk that out. Let's jump over and talk a little bit over on the Microsoft side. We talked last month about Windows Server and kind of decided that we were going to attack this maybe a little bit like a section at a time. And so Brent volunteered to say, each month our Tech to Go, I'll talk a little bit about one of the different sections of Server 2008 and the rest of us learn and react to that. So what are your thoughts this time around, Brent, on Windows 08?
Well, I think there's lots of things, obviously, we can talk about, but I thought maybe we could start by talking about the virtualization piece. Although, you know, the most important thing to convey here is that the virtualization piece in Windows Server 2008, Microsoft has announced, is actually not going to be available at launch in the product. Although, if you look at all of the launch sites and things, they still have a lot of virtualization stuff there, with one exception, and that is the virtualization of applications is going to be in the launch product, which is set for February of next year.
Let me make sure I understand what that virtualization of applications is. Is that kind of what, when they bought that Synchronicity product, is that kind of what they're doing here?
Yeah, it's the product they bought was from a company called Softricity. Softricity, yeah. And the product that Softricity had was called SoftGrid. And what Microsoft has done with that technology, and they're undoubtedly going to do more with it, but what they've done at this point is they've integrated application virtualization into the new terminal services functionality in Windows Server 2008. And so network administrators are going to have the capability out of the box to publish applications to a website, and remote users are going to be able to fire up that application without actually logging on to a terminal server somewhere or to a remote desktop session. So it's true application virtualization from a website, very, very similar to what Citrix calls seamless Windows.
So the application is truly running on my local machine, but it's never, installed, because when I quit using it, it completely disappears, thus the virtualization thing, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Exactly right. All of the program files and DLLs and that kind of thing are available on the server, installed temporarily on the remote client machine, and then rolled back when the session terminates.
So, and make sure, Brent, that everybody understands the difference between that and the traditional terminal services or Citrix version.
Well, the traditional terminal services version requires the remote user to actually log on to a desktop before they can run an application. So it's an extra step. And, of course, all of the applications that have been published to that terminal server or remote desktop are now available to the remote user. But with application virtualization, there's no need for that extra step to get a terminal server desktop. It's a matter of just launching an application. And remote users, you know, may just continually use certain remote applications and not need to actually get a full desktop to do their work.
Interesting. So, what's that going to mean to people practicing public accounting? You got a small firm of, you know, two or three or four people. How might they implement or utilize those kinds of capabilities? How do you see that stuff being used?
You know, as it turns out, I think what will actually happen is we'll wind up, let's use the word provisioning, creating, if you will, the package that delivers the software that we then can use in-house for our applications or obviously from afar. And I think what will even happen beyond that is that the publishers will be able to follow the Microsoft standards, in effect allowing their applications to be delivered in a packaged approach that could be used. So do you think I've interpreted that correctly?
Well, you know, I was just going to jump in here and say I think you're on the right track there. I think the whole business of publishing applications is going to be a little bit different than just allowing applications to run in a terminal server environment, but not significantly different. So if we're talking about tax and accounting specific applications, I think there'll be minimal changes required to make those applications available in this terminal services, what's called remote app environment.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, the way I think that's fitting together, if I have read through the pieces correctly, is that it is going to be actually a little bit like a virtual appliance, yet still terminal server-like in its installation. So if that's in fact the case, that really gives the publishers the ability to have these pre-packaged applications. In the Citrix world, we'd almost think of that as like a published application package.
Well, it kind of sounds to me like this is an interim step, after Citrix Farms and before SaaS, software as a service. Dave, that would kind of give you, as a sole practitioner out in the Blue Ridge Mountains, you want to run an application. It's kind of a one-time thing. You want to do something, that's fairly esoteric, some 1031 exchange type thing or something, and you find a program on the web that that does that. You could actually run that application really on a one-time thing, kind of on demand. It's different than a web application because you're running it locally. Do you see that helping the real small guys?
Absolutely, I do, Greg. Because as you know, one of the problems that faces, and I'll call them actually the typical accounting office, because you're talking for the majority of offices, 10 practitioners or less, one of the problems that you always have is the resource drain and demand of gearing up for every single application you want. And we've seen a lot of efforts within the industry to try to address that problem with the per-use licensing arrangements, for example, that were popular in the 90s. And now what we're actually seeing is technology is beginning to catch up with the demand for this. And I think it's a marvelous way to begin the transition toward a day when the Internet sort of levels the playing field even more than it has already in terms of my ability. And I'll go beyond even, pardon me, a one-time use arrangement. If you look at recurring arrangements such as some of your tax software and also even something as mundane and recurring as payroll and payroll filings, those kinds of applications come up just every now and then. You don't use them every day. You don't need them on your desktop every day. So I think what we're seeing here is not so much a new direction as an extension of what has gone on in the past to take it maybe one step further down the road. And I think it's a good step. It's a step in the right direction.
Well, Brent, the idea of application virtualization certainly sparks a lot of interest, obviously. Is that something that is simple enough for a guy like me to just kind of turn it on once I roll out a server 08, or am I going to have to go out and hire somebody smart like you to do it for me?
Well, it's like any of the advanced server technologies. It can be a little bit challenging, and Microsoft has tried really, really hard in Windows Server 2008 to make implementing these more complex technologies a little bit easier by enhancing what's called the Server Manager. The Server Manager application has been around for some time in Small Business Server, and they've expanded and enhanced it in Windows Server 2008 such that when you run the server manager from the server operating system, you get a series of wizards, which we're all familiar with Microsoft products, that are intended to make the non-technical person more adept at implementing these more advanced technologies. So, the short answer is, more than likely you're going to be able to get it installed. Whether it's going to work exactly the way you want it to without a little help, that remains to be seen.
And that kind of
takes you over to I've listened to Randy talk about hobbyist technologists, and I know you've got some feelings about those of us that like to play with technology. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, as I'm following this one through, this licensing model, it was mentioned, that really does play out well here. And in effect, the publishers could choose to publish these applications kind of as an on-demand pay-for-service. And that business model could absolutely work for the CCHs and so forth. And more importantly, as you talk about the hobbyists here then, in response to your question, Greg, this really lets somebody who doesn't have tons of technical skill access an application if they can get it from a licensed source, if you will. So, if
sure.
We look at what's happening with what has happened with the hosting of QuickBooks as an example, where you really don't have to do anything, you just get to this hosted server farm in the sky. In effect, this is an enabling tool for any application that wants to follow the rules of this new method that Microsoft's making available.
Well, it will be interesting stuff. Let's close down the server 08 thing. I mean, I'm sure there's enough new things in server 08 that we'll probably not get done with it in 08. Will we, Brent? You're going to have another section for us next month?
You bet.
Okay, well that'll be fun. It's almost the end of the year. It's still time to, it's that time to start kind of thinking about tax season. And Randy, I just read your column for the January issue where you talk about upgrades, and I thought it was, as usual, absolutely wonderful and chock full of stuff. So everybody should stay tuned to see that when the January issue hits. But before that, for right now, for the people who tune in and listen to the podcast, let's talk just a little bit about some of the things that people ought to be doing, like Thanksgiving weekend when they go into the office and there's nobody else there. What kinds of things should people be checking off before tax season hits over on the technology side? What do we check off and what do we upgrade?
Well, there have been, Greg, IT checklists that have been created for years, and even running one of those is still wonderful for your technical people to have. But when I was thinking about this article, it was like, what would I go through and just check before the season started? So, some of these sound fairly low level and fairly fundamental, but if you're counting on your outsourced people or your in-house IT people to do them, they just may not have thought about, we're getting close to tax season, we better go do this stuff. So some of the items that I talked about and believe that could be checked starting now and should be checked before the end of the year is just to make sure that some of your fundamental building blocks are right. And I'm going to pick on the firewall just to protect ourselves first. Firewalls really need pretty frequent updates. We're obviously going through another PDF spam attack, much more violent than we saw in the August timeframe right now. And we think that, there is concerted effort to try to penetrate a lot of our operations. And our firewall is our first line of defense. So we want to keep that firewall updated. Also, you can ask for reports from your communications providers, the AT&Ts of the world, if you will, and they can actually give you a look back. Most of the time they can do it for 12 months and more of your performance. And it's actually quite good that you get those performance statistics on a monthly basis anyway from an IT perspective, but before you go into season, it's nice to know, do we have enough capacity? Should we order additional capacity? And we've got enough time probably to still get that done, although we're cutting that one awful close. You know, the servers, perhaps we're installing new, but more likely we have old servers that we've got in service. And there is really, you know, that time to stop and say, look, we're dependent on this device. If it fails during tax season, what's our alternative? And let's do everything we can to make sure that it's solid before we go in. But one of the observations we've had in the last year or two of being on site is in many cases we don't think the IT teams are keeping enough open disk capacities on the servers. And obviously we're going to be adding a lot of documents, perhaps paperless, perhaps otherwise, this season. And I'd like to make sure that the servers really have enough capacity. And one of the old IT rules of thumb was leaving your server disks not completely full, because there's some activities that have to be done by the operating systems, pagination and swapping and things like that. So sometimes when we look at the big numbers of our disk storage and servers today, we think, well, we've got plenty of capacity, but really you need to leave a fair percent of that disk open. And we're going to suggest that once you hit about 80% capacity, you're going to start having problems. And normally, 60% full or less is really optimum. That gives us plenty of space to work and headroom, if you will. You know, you need to just look at that server and say, is this server going to make it through? Do we need to do anything to make sure that everything's okay? You know,
so it's kind of true, Randy, that you can a firm can never be you can't be too rich, too thin, or have too much disk space, right?
That's probably a pretty fair statement, because when you're looking at something like disk and we say, you know, we think we're going to use 10 gig and we've got 20 gig to go, well, unfortunately, 20 gig sounds like a lot of space left over when you're only going to use 10, but you're probably going to be inside the tolerance of what will let the system run properly. So, you know, another real fundamental thing to do is just making sure your backup's right. Clearly, that's something that you can test, if at all possible, you should test in this window, because if something goes wrong, we've got to be able to get back to the backup. It's a fundamental rule, and I find it still violated 20 or 25% of the time. As much as we think we're doing the right types of things, the backups are really still mission critical. And
I think you're real generous with that 25%. I think it's significantly higher than that, in at least in the people that I talk to. Everybody does backups, but the number of people that tested is shockingly small.
Appallingly small would be another way that I'd look at that.
Yep.
And realistically,
better adjective.
Yeah, and really, you've got to have a good backup done daily, tested frequently. And frankly, I have been in firms that, you know, say, well, you know, if we back up every other day, particularly small firms, we back up every other day, that's okay. Well, if you can lose a couple of days worth of work, maybe that is okay, but I certainly wouldn't choose that when backups can be so automated, unattended, and many options there for us to get that job done. This is also a pretty good time just to make sure that you've got your licensing strategy right. You know, coming into the next year, obviously, we've got the new Windows Server, and obviously Vista is probably going to be on our radar, and Office 2007, and perhaps Adobe. But, you know, as it turns out, Adobe obviously has to be on the most current version, version 8.1, to truly be compatible with Office 2007 and Vista. So in terms of any new acquisitions or just strategies, it might be a good time to review your open license agreements with Microsoft, or licensing agreements with Adobe or your antivirus vendors, just like you've probably done your practice software in the last little while. And really, what I'd like you to be thinking about is, what's our strategies for this tax season, for the very short term, and what's our mid-range strategies for 2008? So those become pretty important items just for a quick look. Then, you know, one more fundamental thing I'd just like to mention is UPSs and surge protection. I've had the pleasure of being in 80-plus businesses personally in the last 2 years, both CPA firms and industry, and I have yet to find a single business that had their surge protection and UPS set up right. Not one. And,
wow.
You know, not one. And the idea here is pretty simple, and that is that everything that is computer-related, so your servers and your desktops and your laptops, are all isolated by surge protection, but often overlooked are your printers or your scanners or your multifunction copiers that you're using as a printer and a scanner. It's frequent that those devices that I just named are installed without surge protection. Or, you know, people are trying to do the best thing, and you can have your IT team or your outsourced people go through and set up everything correctly. But what will happen is people get cold or people get hot, so they put their space heaters or fans near their desk and plug them into the surge protection, and it's common that the surge protector will get unplugged or computer equipment will get unplugged and plugged straight into the wall, so there's a convenient place to plug in the space heater. So, you know, just simple little things like that happen frequently, and when you have inadequate surge protection on your networks, something as straightforward as a lightning strike, not quite so common in the winter, but certainly more common as we get back into the summer months, can cause damage anywhere throughout your system. In other words, a lightning strike that comes in through your copier's power, goes down the network cable of the copier, can cross over the switches and land up in a server hard drive, blowing that up. So lightning strikes or surge protection will damage equipment over time and actually lead to a failure perhaps months or maybe even a few years after the actual event occurred. Sometimes it's immediate.
So you can't necessarily trace it back to that. It's just, this is, some of this is just, it's almost like preventive maintenance. You know, just think it's management by walking around. Isn't that what it is?
Truly is. And, you know, I'm really amazed that, you know, our mobile workers, the auditors that go out, you know, a lot of firms don't put surge protection on their laptops. And when they come back into the office, the auditors just grab the nearest plug and plug in. So you've got that laptop not protected in the field and you've got it not protected in the office. And the protection there is like $17 quantity one for really good stuff. So, you know, this is very, very inexpensive items. And, you know, while you're looking at the surge protection, it's a great time to look at the ergonomics, because also every business I've been in the last 2 years has had ergonomic issues. They have not set up their monitors, their keyboards, their mice comfortably for the people to use according to very well-known ergonomic approaches. So, you know, again, just a little bit of wandering around here can really make everybody's life easier during these coming months.
Well, that's it's interesting stuff, and I certainly appreciate the input and the article. So I look forward to getting that out. And there's some really good tips for practitioners. Dave, anything that you would add to that in terms of what people ought to be checking out, you know, kind of year end before busy season? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously I'd reiterate the backup situation again. Backing up your files is the IT equivalent of flossing your teeth. Everyone knows you have to do it, and you have to do it, and so many just don't. And, you know, someday your teeth all fall out if you don't. The other thing I would really bring up, though, Greg, is this is an excellent time to review your archiving and storage capabilities and your technologies there. You know, just in the past year, as we've commented previously this year, the whole archiving and storage base has been altered so dramatically by new technologies. This is really the year when you have to sit down and take this seriously and look at the whole paperless office, which is finally, 20 years after we started talking about it, beginning to become real.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting stuff. Brent, give me one thing that you're going to do in your firm year end that we haven't already talked about.
I would say probably the thing that I would add would be to schedule some some training sessions, make sure that, that staff are familiar with the tools and the, and more importantly, the processes that the firm is going to use to ensure a smooth transition through tax season.
Certainly can't argue with the importance of training. You got to keep doing that just over and over and over. Couple of other things on our list. We had a listener send me a note said that they would like us to talk a little bit about instant messaging. And I kind of see people all over the board on this. And personally, I use a product called Trillion Pro, which allows me basically to communicate with people who are using all the different disparate systems of instant messaging. It's still kind of a cobbled up system of some people are MSN and some are Yahoo and some are AOL and some are ICQ. All of these different things. Trillion lets me put those all together. And I'm going to say everybody on the magazine staff on my list and a couple of you guys that are regular columnists that I communicate with regularly are on my IM list. And I kind of live with it. If I were practicing, I think I would probably have maybe a half dozen or so of my premier clients I would keep on my IM list. But I go into firms, they have some people would tell me they'd never use IM, and other network administrators are very concerned about even allowing IM to be turned on. Anybody else have thoughts? Dave, are you an IM guy or not?
You know, I'm not, Greg, and I'll tell you why. There are several issues involved here. One, of course, for an enterprise operation is the ease with which you can penetrate an IM system. They certainly haven't done as good a job there in security as they could, and particularly in the weakness now that IM systems are so much more capable in file sending and file sharing. I think it opens up big security holes in the organization. And for smaller firms, it's even more difficult to mount a good security defense for them. Secondarily, I have problems in that IM simply isn't mobile enough for me. In an era in which I can text message to anyone, to virtually anyone's cell phone much more easily without being tethered to my computer, I frankly ditched IM a long time ago for text messaging.
Okay, I use text messaging too, but that's pretty much a cell phone driven operation as opposed to computer operation. But it's an interesting approach, Brent. What do you guys do? Are you an IM shop or no?
Yeah, we are. We've used Live Communications Server for 2-3 years now, and mostly internal. We're just evaluating the value of the external presence capabilities that are built into the new version of that product. The most advantage that we've found with IM to date is quick answers to quick questions without having to jump on the phone, or more importantly, we know that somebody's on the phone and we need to get a quick message to them. IM seems to work well for that as well. And we've used it with desktop support situations by allowing someone to take a quick look at a application that's misbehaving or something happening on the desktop.
So you use it only internally, and nobody in the office is using it to communicate with key clients or anything?
Not really at this point. We have a few that use the standard MSN Messenger, which is, we're not particularly thrilled with the security associated with that product, but we have not federated our LCS machine at this point for external use, and we're evaluating that right now.
Okay. So do you see any difference between some of your younger staff? They tend to look at email as stuff that old people like me use, and you know, there I am in text messaging. I mean, that's where they live. Do younger people look at it differently, do you see?
Yeah, I think they do, but it's not necessarily an age thing, in my opinion. It's the medium. So email, by nature, by definition, is one of those communication technologies that doesn't require an immediate response. You send an email, then even though you think you may want an immediate response, the nature of email is you're going to get a response when you get a response. And instant messaging is kind of just the opposite of that. With presence built in, the whole idea of checking to see if somebody's online and that they're available from a presence standpoint means that you're looking for an immediate answer, and that's why you would use the instant messaging tool as opposed to an email tool.
Well, I certainly see the IM thing as a if not an age thing. You know, there's an interesting book. A guy by the name of Mark Prinsky wrote a book called Digital Natives, Digital Immigrants, and he talks in that book about the difference in the way people think from the people who grew up in a digital world. This is probably people who are certainly under maybe 25 or maybe 30. But for those of us who are older than that, we will always be immigrants. And in fact, John Barron talked about that particular book. It was interesting because I just listened to the book recently, and John talked about it in his keynote at the Thompson Conference. And I was visiting with John about it later, and John's example to me of recognizing the difference between a digital native and a digital immigrant, he said a tip-off for me is when somebody says to me, "I just bought a new digital camera," that's obviously a digital immigrant, because a true native would never consider using the word digital to describe a camera, because it's a camera, obviously it's digital. And I found that kind of interesting. It even goes to the words that we use. So I, at that point, I challenged him to think about the name of his product, File Cabinet Solution. And that was kind of a good laugh. Randy, I know that you're an IM guy. How do you see it used, and how do you use it?
Well, you know, the things we've heard so far are dead on. This immediacy of response and presence, I think, winds up being a big deal as we go forward into exchange and integrating voice over IP and some of those elements. Personally, as many of the listeners know, I actually own two different companies, my K2 company and my network management group company. NMGI, I would say, is concerned about security, so we actually use the Microsoft Communications tool to get our instant messaging done internally, and we've actually federated that to hundreds and I would say thousands of users around the country, so we can actually see presence of other technical people. So if we need expertise in a Cisco router problem, or we need expertise on a Citrix problem, we know who qualifies on that. We can see if they're online around the country. That's been very, very helpful, and we use that for my NMGI business. On the K2 side, most of our group uses the same Trillion product you do, and that's really to accommodate those different non-secure systems, the AOL messengers, the MSN messengers, the Yahoo messengers, and put them all in one place. So I actually live in both sides of the world, and we made the decision, though, in the case of our communications NMGI version, not to make the connection to the outside world just from a security perspective. So there's really only a couple of three vendors that actually have secure instant messaging, Microsoft's product being one of those examples, IBM's product being another example, and so forth. So I really want people to think about their tolerance for security and their need for the immediacy of communication. There's nothing like instant messenger to know the presence and the availability of somebody. And what happens is after the initial gloss wears off, you really aren't interrupted any more than you'd be interrupted with a cell phone call or a telephone call. And you will have the discipline to get off the instant messenger and get on the phone when you realize it's starting to turn into a typing match. So, again, it becomes an extra tool in the kit that I think can really drive up productivity.
See it as much less intrusive than a phone call.
Yes, it is for me. And, you know, just because of being out of the office enough, and I'm going to pick on audit teams as an example in this area, you really know that a person is really available or not available and could be reachable. And for short things, we can confirm questions almost immediately, which keeps the person asking the question productive and, frankly, probably requires less of a response because it's a short and immediate response than something that has to be explained and accumulated and then perhaps errors made before a correct decision could be executed.
Right. Well, it's interesting. It's certainly got a ways to go. I mean, I start looking at Trillion and I see all these different people using all these different systems, I realize how silly we've built this. It's, you know, I can't talk to you because you're MSN and I'm Yahoo. That's just insane. We've not done a very good job as a whole, I don't know, industry or society of building but I think a lot of people are using it, and it'll be interesting to see where we go in the future.
One other thing I'd mention in our usage at NMGI is we're actually using it for poor boy video conferencing. So with a simple camera either built into the machines or an add-on, we do voice over IP and video conferencing via that product with a fair bit of success, which might be enough for the firms that have multi-location to at least consider that as opposed to a high-end expensive video conferencing system.
You know, I do exactly the same thing. You know, and most of the, you know, a lot of monitors now come with cameras built in. My laptop's got a camera built in, and that's a good description of it. Poor boy video conferencing. It's certainly acceptable. Not perfect, but certainly acceptable, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, for a short business conference or a short family to family call. You know, much better to see the person on the other end and get a little reaction to what they're doing than just working off the voice.
That's exactly right. When I got back from, I was out for a couple of weeks, you know, at a couple of conferences, and when I got back, one of my voicemails was an automated voicemail from Microsoft, and they told me that there are new rules for the MPAN Action Pack that after November 30th, and that's coming up very, very quickly, if you renew after November 30th, and they say in response to partner requests, quote unquote, that's what they say, after November 30th, Microsoft will require that you take an online assessment course to qualify for the Action Pack. Now, this is not for MPAN, but just for the Action Pack, and that's the $400 goodie bag full of, I don't know, probably $25,000 worth of software. Most of us have been talking about and telling people, accountants all across the country, to sign up for that, and now it appears they're going to have to take an online assessment course. Brent, you're up there in their area, and you know everything about Microsoft. What the heck are they doing?
Well, it was clear that I didn't know too much about this, which is why I sent you an email yesterday. But having received your email and made some calls to some contacts at Microsoft, I think I understand it a lot more. Their statement that in response to partner requests, obviously, those requests aren't coming from the Action Pack users. Why would they want to do more to get this thousands of dollars worth of Microsoft software for a bargain price? That just doesn't make any sense. the partners that are requesting this are the certified and the gold partners who are tired of being out there going in and trying to sell, let's say, a small business server to an accounting firm, and the accounting firm's response is, you go ahead and get the hardware. I've already got the software. I picked up a membership in the MPAN program, and I have the Action Pack, and I'm just going to provide the software. So obviously,
sure.
These other partners, it's biting into their business a little bit, and that's where this request is coming from. They're just raising the bar here.
I'm certainly going to. Renew before November 30th. Tell me what the online assessment courses are. Are these trivial, or is this something for people to be very concerned about? Is it going to chop off a huge number of people? What's going to happen?
They're not extremely difficult, but it's a time commitment, and obviously. You know, with a 70% passing requirement, it's going to enforce that time commitment on behalf of those who want to continue to get the Action Pack, and it's intended to separate those who are just trying to pick up a bunch of free software and those that are serious about reselling or even recommending Microsoft products.
So, Dave, are you an MPAN or Action Pack guy or no?
I am. I'm sitting here listening as we talk about it. I'm probably one of the guys they want to weed out, because while I do obviously a great deal of recommending, I'm probably not a partner at the level that they really would like to have. I'm sitting here quietly thinking to myself, oh, my God, how do I ever qualify for this? Because I'm not a CPA in practice. As you know, I'm a technologist in practice, which is a somewhat different matter. I think while it's helpful to them in terms of reducing the number of gawkers and people who just want the free software, I wonder if long-term they're not just putting a hurdle in place of maybe smaller firms who will just maybe have the same reaction as me and shy away and say, wow, you know, they're not looking for me. They're looking for another gold partner, and I don't qualify, so I won't bother. Maybe the solution is, and certainly I won't dictate to Microsoft, but maybe the solution is to look at maybe a better system of tiering for their partnership programs and the qualifications so that smaller firms that maybe do less recommendation or have fewer clients can still qualify for, say, a more basic bundle. Does that make any sense?
So a little bit more granular kind of a system, not a either or, but maybe kind of a step process.
I'd sure like to see that, yes.
So, Randy, you're usually way ahead of the curve on this. Did you know about this, or what are your thoughts?
As a matter of fact, I'm going to give you several pieces of background, but we've known about this for probably 90 or 120 days or more. I actually physically took the inbound call that you got a voicemail on, and oddly enough, while I was talking to the person, I got another voicemail in the background, so I heard the recorded version as well as talked to a person live. And had also talked directly to Bob Lewis about some of the requirements. And as you heard earlier in the conversation on this podcast, you might know that I have the NMGI business, which is a gold-certified Microsoft partner with multiple specialties, including networking and some others. So we would probably be in the class where, you know, according to the information earlier, we'd be the type of partner that would actually say, ooh, this is a problem. As it turns out, we're the opposite, but it's probably because of our attitude. When we run into the accounting firms that haven't gotten into MPAN, we encourage them to join. There are hundreds of tests to choose from to take this, and I do have to requalify myself between now and November 30th, so I'm going to go take a test. I've actually looked at some of the tests. And, you know, I think Brent's assessment is exactly right. They're not particularly difficult, but you do have a time commitment there. some of the tests are almost too easy from my vantage point, but there will be tests across a broad areas of expertise, and I think they actually will not be a really big deal for most people to take and pass, but the time commitment I'm not super wild about. Even at that, though, I think the time commitment's worth the extended support, the reduced price in software, and other things that are inside the MPN and Action Pack program. So even with the testing, I am going to encourage people to continue to join it. I do think, though, that the assessment about smaller firms dropping out because they're saying, man, this is just too much effort, I'll just spend the money. I think some of that will happen. And in effect, it will filter the partners a little bit in the program to be ones that are a little more serious about knowing what Microsoft has and being able to talk intelligently about their product offerings.
Well, I suspect you're right. And I guess my the final advice that I think we would probably leave with all of our listeners is it's about a 90-second deal to go online and renew your membership before November 30th. That at least delays the whole problem for a full year. And by this time next year, it'll be people will have a much better idea of which tests are appropriate for those, what I'm going to call low and mid-level partners, the firms that buy it, basically for the software, and we'll just know a lot more about it. So go out and renew and go from there. Listen, we're right at an hour. The last item on our list was a real quick, simple one. What do you want for Christmas? My email said, what are geeky accountants eyeing as a potential gift? So I'll do a quick roundtable. Randy, what's on your technology wish list?
Well, I'm a pretty simple guy on this one. Sometimes I go also to the real complex side. So I think my favorite item is a security tool that actually can be put on a USB, and it really is like complete security tool on a USB type of approach. So, that particular item, I think, will become a big deal as we go further down the road, but it's not like something you'd buy for your home. So I guess, with that in mind, you may not just run right out and, buy the Catbird Pocket V Agent, which is what I want. But what I'd suggest is that you go after the Blu-ray disc and the HDTV. I think that's still the call. If you haven't upgraded your TV viewing experience, go there. And I do have my home server on order, but it's back ordered. So maybe by Christmas I'll have the home server we discussed a couple of podcasts ago.
I'm hoping that mine is also back ordered from Amazon, and I'm looking for it any day. I bought the HP 1 terabyte. What'd you buy, Randy?
HP 1 terabyte.
Okay. Well, I one of these days we'll get them. And of course, Brent's already way ahead of us. He's got his up and running. I've put on my Christmas list, I want a TiVo Series 3 for my living room. I've got a couple of them in the house, and TiVo just announced that they have. They have again introduced lifetime product service. If you already have a machine that has lifetime product service, you can buy that same service for a new machine. And so, for well under $1,000, I can go out and get one of those big Series 3s with lifetime service. Get rid of that piece of junk that Comcast has got in here and. Save myself $20+ a month from the cable company and have something that's a lot better, and I'm pretty excited about having that on my list. We'll see whether or not it gets delivered. If it doesn't, I may have to buy it myself. So, Dave, what's on your technology wish list?
Well, as you know, Greg, I can never do things quite as simply as everybody else. I do have home server on my list, but I have a list of 10. Let me run down them very quickly. Obviously, the Apple iPhone. Now that they're going to be opening up to third parties, pretty good chance that they'll get Outlook synchronization in it as one of the first ones. I think it's just going to continue to be a great cell phone. Second, the Xbox 360. It's got a media center built in. You have to buy Wi-Fi separately, but Xbox just continues to grow as a platform for media services. I'd go with a Garmin GPS service. Now, obviously, the Street Pilot C580 is the sort of midline navigation system, but I'm really crazy about the Zumo 550. It's portable, so you can take it into rental cars, etc. It has a mounting device for motorcycles, which, as a Honda guy, I really appreciate, and has Bluetooth and XM available as well. So, great GPS system. XM radio, still a great buy, still a terrific way to listen to the radio if you do a lot of traveling. The Logitech Harmony 880 remote. If you have a lot of devices and you're bewildered with how to set them up, the Harmony, though it's a little on the pricey side, a couple hundred bucks, it's a great remote that controls everything and does it in a way that you can enter stuff from your PC and synchronize it. Works pretty well. I like the Slingbox AV because I do a lot of traveling on airplanes, and I like to download TV shows and movies, especially as the airlines are cutting back on those services. Verizon's fiber optic service, Fios, if you can get it, get it. Merry Christmas. That's probably the thing that's number one on my wish list. Finally, just a couple of last ones. Drobo from Data Robotics is an automated storage device that lets you hot swap virtually any kind of drive and any size of drive in and out. If you're looking for a backup and an archiving solution for a small office, look at Drobo. It's inexpensive. It's a great, probably my number one business technology. And finally, for the home, if you're going to get that big screen HDTV and all of that, invest in the Yamaha YSP-4000 digital sound projector. Instead of having to buy all of those individual speakers plus a tuner plus the whole surround sound thing, this is one device, pricey at about $1,600, but it does a great job of creating surround sound without cluttering your whole living room with speakers or hanging things off walls or running wires. It's a great device. I think everybody should have one. So that's my list of 10.
You know, Dave, I'll bet as a kid when you got up to Santa Claus, the rest of the kids in line got darn tired of you going up there with your list of 10 or 12 things, didn't they?
Absolutely, but I live for my
tech toys.
You've got
a great list there, and you made me realize as you were going through it what a geek I am, because I actually already own almost all of those things.
Well,
many of them are great. The Touch is great. The Logitech Harmony is awesome. Good suggestions. Brent, what do you got on yours? I'll bet it's a lot simpler than Dave's one.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, I'm like you, Greg. I already have a lot of those things. I'm really waiting for the release of Xbox Zephyr, you know, the new version of Xbox, because I want that enhanced media experience around the house without having to worry about the red ring of death.
Well, I have so far my rings are still green, and that's what I want for Christmas, is them to stay green for a while. So, hey, listen, guys, we're about 7 or 8 minutes over, and so we need to wrap up. Just a couple of things at the end. Our next recording is 4:30 Central Time on Wednesday, the 19th of December. So 4:30 Central, Dave, that's 3:30 for you. We can all do that math, and I'll send the invites out so we've all got it. And for you listeners, if you want to come in, join us on TalkShoe, that's where we'll be, 4:30 Central Time on Wednesday, the 19th. We've got we'll have a bunch of year-end things to talk about, and one of the things that we're going to have on the list next month, in response to a couple of notes that I got from people, is a discussion on mobile workers. What do you put in your briefcase? What's in the bag when you go out into the field? And I know, Randy, you live in the field, and I've seen you pull things out of your bag that I go, oh, boy, I wish I'd have thought of taking that with me. So I think that'll be a real helpful thing. So for those of you who are mobile or who send teams out into the field, be sure to tune in for next month, and we'll discuss some of those things. I think you'll find that that interesting. So I guess that's pretty much what we've got for the month. Again, thanks to ADP. And if you do have comments or thoughts, you can send us email or dial in, leave us a voicemail. It's 1-800-456-0864. And the extension for Tech2Go is 2106. So again, it's 800-456-0864, extension 2106. And we will see you next month, 4:30 p.m. Central, Wednesday the 19th. Guys, thanks very much. Randy, Dave, Brent, have a great Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you soon. This is Tech2Go, episode 11. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next month.
That wraps up this edition of Tech2Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust. This has been a podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.